Welcome to Power Problems. I'm John Glazer. My guest today is Stephen Ward. He's in the Department of Politics and International Studies at the University of Cambridge, and he's the author of a recent book, Status and the Challenge of Rising Powers. Stephen, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, John. Really nice to be here.
What's your view about the role that status motivations and status-seeking behavior plays in international politics?
So I understand status to be a state's position in the international hierarchy, and it's based on performances of consensually valued practices and the possession of sort of consensually valued symbolic markers. But importantly, it also depends on recognition. So you can't have status unless relevant other actors treat you in ways that imply that you indeed have that status. So I think status plays a lot of different roles in international politics. And over the last 20, 30 years, there's been a kind of explosion of research on all the different ways in which status motives matter. A lot of this has to do with belligerence. States that feel undervalued have been shown to behave more belligerently. Some authors suggest that status motives can also induce a sort of cooperative or stabilizing behavior, that some states might be motivated to sort of act like good states or sort of uphold norms about different forms of morality as ways of chasing status. And my own work sort of looks at this in a couple of different ways. The book is primarily about a very disruptive form of behavior that status concerns can provoke, that states that feel permanently blocked from achieving the status that they think they deserve, sometimes sort of lash out against the status quo.
How do you, as a political scientist, begin to try to measure status as a causal factor in international politics? It seems harder than some of the other factors that scholars focus on.
Well, I actually don't know if that's true. I think it's pretty hard to measure power. I think that status is certainly challenging because it is intrinsically sort of in the eyes of the beholder, right? So what we care about is not necessarily how you rank in terms of wealth or military power, but rather how the rest of the world sees you. One of the ways that authors have done this has been to use diplomatic exchange data to try to generate a quantitative indicator of status. So the idea basically is that states that attract a lot of diplomatic representatives from other states must be really important, so we can construct an indicator on that basis. I've always been a little bit skeptical of that. And so in a lot of my work, I'm less interested in actually measuring status than I am in recovering evidence related to status motives, perceptions of status. And I'm less interested in understanding associations between status and consistency and different kinds of behaviors than I am in uncovering sort of evidence related to mechanisms through which status concerns might influence foreign policy.
Okay, so the argument that you lay out in your book hinges on this idea that much of the tension between rising powers and dominant powers is due to the dominant power's resistance to making changes or accommodations that might satisfy the rising power's need for some kind of status recognition. And you make an important distinction in saying that security concerns per se are not primary here. What actually drives the conflict is more of these collective psychological needs. Before we get into some of your case studies, just give us a broad overview of your theory.
Yeah, so the theory basically is that So the theory is scoped to rising powers, but the dynamics don't necessarily only have to live there. But so let's talk about rising powers, just for sort of purposes of the argument. So the idea is that as rising states become more powerful and sort of more aware of their sort of clout in the international system, they, and I'm using they as a shorthand here, what I mean is elites who identify with the state and parts of the public that identify with the state and care about the state, right? That they become, they aspire to hold a position or a status that they feel is sort of appropriate given their new importance. They kind of borrow these desires from existing great powers, and they do things to try to convince other powers to take them seriously, to recognize their status claims. And the problems occur when, for one reason or another, those status ambitions or status claims seem to be rejected repeatedly, and often in ways that suggest that there's a kind of a structural or systemic obstacle blocking satisfaction of the status ambition. And that has a couple of kinds of effects. It can produce sort of social psychological reactions that lead people to want to protest against and reject the status quo. And so that can operate within the heads of leaders. It can also produce dissatisfaction and demands for rejectionist foreign policies among important domestic audiences, especially audiences composed of sort of strong nationalists. So those forces together can, given the right circumstances, push states into doing things that make very little sense in terms of security motives.
Okay, so let's dive into a little bit of history here. How does this apply to Wilhelmine Germany?
So the argument that I make in the book is that during the decades before World War I, Germany's a rising power, and especially under Kaiser Wilhelm II, becomes sort of obsessed with achieving at least parity with the British. And that implies sort of naval parity and being treated equally around the world. The British are not really interested in accommodating those claims. This then leads to the emergence of a group of domestic elites that are increasingly sort of convinced that Germany needs to overthrow the European status quo order in order to achieve this sort of status ambitions that they think are important. So this doesn't lead directly to World War I, but it certainly produces a willingness among some actors to run risks that make that outcome more likely.
You also cover the rise of the United States as a really dominant power in the 1890s, and you discuss the approach that Great Britain at the time took. What was unique about that?
Yeah, so this is a negative case in the book. So it's a case of a rising power that that has status ambitions, right? There's no question that some elites care about status in the United States. Theodore Roosevelt cares about status, cares about sort of being a great power. Not everyone, of course, but there are some influential elites in the United States that care about status. But what's different about this case is that the British end up accommodating the United States. The British end up accommodating American claims to basically a sphere of influence in the Western Hemisphere. And it's an interesting story. Part of the reason that the British wind up accommodating American claims, I argue anyway, has to do with stuff going on in South Africa, but also has to do with a sort of notion of a kind of racial brotherhood this sort of Anglo-Saxonism that means that what could have been a status competition between the United States and Great Britain turns into a sort of common project aimed at advancing the status of Anglo-Saxon civilization in the world. And this lays the foundation for the sort of emergence of the special relationship.
Fast forwarding, talk about the ways you think status might kind of influence American behavior on the global stage. It seems as the kind of dominant power or global superpower or indispensable nation and so forth, that we have a lot of status seeking and status motivations going on. How does that manifest in U.S. foreign policy?
Absolutely. So this is, you're sort of getting outside the bounds of the book, which is fine. This is actually some of my ongoing work is about decline and the sort of domestic politics of status anxiety in the context of decline. But there, I don't think there's any question that status concerns inflect American foreign policy. I'm teaching U.S. foreign policy this term to Cambridge students, and just taught Ahsan Butt's recent security studies article. In which he makes the argument that basically the invasion of Iraq was a performative, an attempt to perform dominance emerging from a sort of a humiliation after 9/11. And this is actually consonant with some other work, right? Jocelyn Barnhart has written about humiliation. And it's possible, actually, that sort of being at the top makes you more prone to concerns about being humiliated. And so that might actually lead to sort of more status inflected or status anxious belligerent behavior and also make it harder to accommodate the claims of a rising power.
I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the role of domestic politics in this story. It seems like one takeaway from your book is that although we tend to think of international conflict as coming down to some kind of incompatible security need out in the international world, and or some tangible, non-divisible dispute over, say, territory or something, but actually the dynamics of domestic politics is a very real obstacle to international peace and can often be the driver of international conflict. And we see this kind of unhelpful nationalist populist rhetoric in the United States, which seems to come with really an electoral advantage and therefore seems maybe to be at least in part driven from the bottom up in our own politics. So talk a little bit about this aspect of your argument.
Yeah, so I would say not just this book, but my sort of work more broadly is very much interested in the domestic politics of status competition. So in the book, I argue that actually in a lot of these cases that I look at, you've got sort of moderate realist-y elites who understand the sort of strategic incentives that their states have to behave moderately. That's the case in pre-World War I Germany. That's the case in Japan before 1931. And that's the case in interwar Germany, too. And part of what goes wrong is that sort of repeated evidence of status immobility empowers hardliners. And their arguments eventually become very difficult to sustainably oppose. And that contributes to this sort of shift among these rising powers against the status quo order, again, in ways that kind of go beyond what they needed to do to ensure their security, right? And you mentioned the United States, and I think I'll talk a little bit about my ongoing unpublished work, which is basically that a very similar process happens when states are experiencing decline. That anxiety about status, partly for reasons related to social psychology, drives people apart drives groups of people apart. Some people become very, very committed to restoring the state status. That's these kind of populist nationalists that you're talking about. And some people become uninterested or want to sort of shift resources elsewhere. This can contribute to domestic conflict, but which ultimately makes it harder to adjust to decline in ways that might be sensible if we were just thinking about security.
Is it possible that America seems to sort of get a lot of status recognition from its outsized role in the world, and therefore any adjustment to that outsized role, any sort of reduction in the number of countries we are treaty-bound to protect, for example, or a rollback in a global military presence and having a global military base presence, those would seem like a hit to status. Those would seem like some kind of psychological hit. And instead of maintaining those commitments in order to protect our security or even global security, we maintain them in order to kind of protect our self-image. Does that make sense?
I think there's something to that. I would not necessarily agree with the notion that the U.S. derives status from its deployments abroad. For instance, I think it's definitely true that certain elites think that the U.S. derives status from those situations. That's all tied up in the logic of primacy and goes back decades and decades. And at this point, this sort of socialized, as sort of Patrick Porter, you know, puts it, as an almost habitual attachment, right? Are people consciously thinking about the potential status losses that might come if you move 4,000 troops out of South Korea or not? Maybe not. But I would also note that Trump. I don't want to talk about Trump much, this is really interesting, right? So Trump's skepticism of the maintenance of basically sort of liberal hegemony or primacy is also status based. If you go back and you look at what he's saying, even as early as 1990, he's basically saying that the liberal international order is for suckers, right? The U.S. is just getting sort of made a fool of by its allies, because it's not squeezing enough out of them in exchange for providing them protection, and that's fundamentally a status argument. It's a very different kind of status argument.
Let's talk a little bit about China. How do you think status-seeking behavior is operating in the U.S.-China relationship?
So, I mean, I should preface this by saying that I'm not a China expert. I don't study Chinese foreign policy, but I don't think there's much question that China is status-sensitive and has aspirations to status parity, at least with the United States, that is probably not compatible with the maintenance of American dominance in East Asia. I think the argument that China wants a sphere of influence, they don't put it like that. Chinese leadership would expressly say they don't want a sphere of influence. But I think it's pretty compelling that what they're interested in is effectively a sphere of influence. That spheres of influence are typically seen as privileges that attach to great powers, so they're status inflected, and that's fundamentally incompatible with the role that the United States has played since the end of World War II. And it doesn't seem to be a role that American leaders are sort of willing to give up. And as you mentioned, maybe that has to do with status. Right. Maybe part of the reason that American leaders are sort of talking in ways that suggest that they want to move away from the sort of great power sphere of influence model is precisely because the whole world is an American sphere of influence. And why would we want to change that? And I think that this complicates things. So I think that, for instance, Taiwan is back in the news, Charlie Glazer a couple years ago wrote this really interesting article suggesting that the U.S. could improve relations with China by negotiating some kind of a deal where Taiwan is unified, becomes a part of the People's Republic in exchange for the Chinese recognizing the legitimacy of the United States military presence offshore. And that strikes me as, you know, as bad as that would be for Taiwan, also as basically unrealistic because it doesn't give enough credit. It doesn't attend seriously enough to Chinese status ambitions, right? Part of the problem in interwar Germany was that the sort of negotiations over the end of reparations and the end of the occupation of the Rhineland were represented on the German right as sort of Germany being made to purchase what it thought belonged to it by right. And this strikes me as a similar situation. I would just also note that status conflicts also complicate efforts to deal with climate change, that there's a sense in which China is being asked to perform as a responsible great power without being given the rights, the rights and privileges of a great power, at least as that's been understood for a couple hundred years.
How do you draw the line between whether or not China just wants to be sort of a member of the great powers club and obtain the status that's that is associated with, or that it seeks more substantive alterations to the existing order?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really hard question. And I think probably the only answer that I can give you is that we have to wait until history has taken its course, and then we can write a fuller analysis. But this is one of the challenges that I remember going back and forth with my dissertation advisor on. You know, well, if you could write a dissertation telling us exactly when a kind of moderate revisionist has turned into an extreme revisionist, that would be wonderful. And I just think that that's difficult to do in real time. There are certain things that I would look for. I mean, I think that if China if China started to do some of the things that the United States was doing under Trump, that would be a red flag, right? So if China starts sort of making noise about withdrawing from international institutions, I think that would be the kind of thing that would get my attention.
Some say that, you know, the international system, as it's been set up and as China has been welcomed into it over the years, is greatly beneficial to China. And so they might not want to make substantial changes for the sake of their status. And if it's the case that the United States can make accommodations that are kind of surface level and not a huge cost to U.S. national security or global security, does it make sense to at least try those accommodationist routes to see if it satisfies China or quiets, sort of lowers the temperature?
I feel like this is kind of what engagement was about. This sort of combination of, you know, the idea that we want to hedge by sort of getting ready to contain China while also engaging them and trying to integrate them within the liberal order. I guess I'll say two things. One is that I think that the standard by which we assess whether that works has been flawed. So in the 2017 NSS, the National Security Strategy that was published by the Trump administration at the end of 2017, they say engagement has failed because China hasn't become a liberal democracy. I think that's the wrong standard. The standard is whether China is a normal great power, right? Whether it's kind of behaving like a responsible great power doesn't mean it has to be a liberal democracy. So I think that's a problem. The other thing that I'll say is I just think that if we're serious about accommodating Chinese status claims, it's very likely to be more costly than inviting Chinese leaders to high level summits or exceeding in their desire to host the Olympics or things like that. I mean, these are, as you say, sort of surface level issues, and they don't really cut to the heart of what distinguishes a great power or a superpower from a state that's not.
Okay, so that kind of begs the question. What does your work tell us about what makes sense for the United States and its posture towards China, given these status competition that's going on?
If it were my job to answer that question, I think I would be getting paid more. So what I'll say is this. The middle path, the sort of middle path routes that avoid the hard decisions are, I think, the ones that are unlikely to work. So I think that there are reasonable people who can argue either that the U.S. needs to seriously contain China, defend its allies in East Asia. These are its most important, longest-standing allies, some of its most important, longest-standing allies in the world. And I am sympathetic to the argument, the many arguments in favor of staying the course. But I think that that decision needs to be taken with clear eyes. People making that argument need to acknowledge that the result is going to be a deeply revisionist China and a probably decades long rivalry that's going to be expensive. On the other hand, if you're interested in accommodating China, if you're interested in trying to avoid the emergence of a sort of deeply revisionist China, it's hard to see how that happens while the U.S. maintains basically global primacy. I think that at this point, you know, I'm not advocating either approach. What I'm advocating is a serious debate that acknowledges that we can't have our cake and eat it too.
I also want to get in this question about a recent paper you wrote with Paul Musgrave about tripwires. First of all, why don't you explain what tripwires are to the audience, what the logic of having a foreign base in another country is, and how, what do you guys find in the paper?
So, actually the question about what tripwires are is one that's tripped us up with reviewers. We're actually not interested in the question of what a tripwire is. We're interested in an effect, right? So the tripwire effect. So the question is, how do you deter? How do you set up a situation in which an extended deterrent threat, that is a deterrent threat that is meant to prevent aggression against a partner, an ally, not against yourself, is taken seriously, is credible, right? And so one way of doing this, at least since the early part of the Cold War, has been to position troops inside that partner or near that partner's territory. Often these are not large numbers of troops. Theoretically, one might achieve a deterrent effect by positioning enough troops to materially change the balance of capabilities, but often that's not what we're doing. Often what we're doing is setting up something that has been described by Thomas Schelling and others as a tripwire. So basically the idea is a couple thousand troops. And if the potential adversary attacks the host and comes into conflict with those troops, or in some formulations kills them, what that will do is automate escalation. So the action can't stop there. An escalation by the sender, the home country of the tripwire troops, is virtually guaranteed, and the expectation is supposed to deter. The expectation of escalation is supposed to deter, and people are not always clear about how exactly this works. Your own writing, among others, has been some that is unusually clear about this. And what Paul and I are interested in is this sort of domestic political mechanism. So the idea is that even if you have a leader that him or herself might be reluctant to escalate after an attack on a tripwire. The reason that this is especially credible is because domestic political audiences are likely to demand escalation in response to an attack on a tripwire. And this is simultaneously cited as support for the functioning of tripwires by their proponents, and also by critics. It's cited as a source of unintended escalation, basically get drawn into wars that you have no business being in because domestic audiences demand escalation when these forward deployed troops get attacked. And so a couple years ago, Paul and I just sort of realized that we didn't really know anything about whether this worked. Obviously, it's a hard thing to study. It's very much like audience costs, where if the theory works, you don't expect to see a lot of attacks on tripwires. So we wouldn't expect necessarily to be able to observe actual reactions to attacks on forward deployed troops. So what we decided to do was to field a number of survey experiments where we described kind of hypothetical situations where the United States had troops deployed overseas, and then describe attacks against these host countries, and then vary whether or not casualties were experienced, whether or not, and the number. So what we found was that while there's a small effect associated with casualties resulting from attacks on tripwires, it's surprisingly weak, we think. It's not large enough to sort of shift opinion from balance or majority against to majority in favor, we don't think. And it also only arises when relatively large numbers of casualties occur. And so this leads us to be a little bit skeptical of at least the domestic political mechanism that presidents, for instance, would actually be driven to escalate because a domestic audience demanded it in response to an attack on a tripwire. It could still be, tripwires could still, forward deployments could still deter. And it could also still be that presidents believe that domestic audiences would demand escalation in response to an attack on a tripwire. And actually, that's sort of part of the justification for doing this project, is that if leaders wrongly believe that, it's worth setting them straight.
So I remember a few years ago, there were several U.S. soldiers who were killed in, I think, Niger. And we went through this rigmarole of, you know, members of the Senate admitting that they weren't even aware we had troops there and so on. And I suppose with the American people, they're largely ignorant as well of where we have these tripwire forces throughout the world. And I don't recall a significant ground up push to escalate that conflict. Of course, it's different than tripwire forces. But if something happens on the Korean Peninsula or in Europe that, you know, I'm a little skeptical that the American people at this point in time would be gung-ho to escalate some kind of continental conflict. And therefore, the credibility gain that policymakers think they're getting from tripwire forces is at the very least dubious. You have to demonstrate that that might be true. And if this is the case, then does it make a ton of sense for us to spend lots of money maintaining a global military presence?
No, I don't think so. I guess where Paul and I have come down, at least in the working manuscript, is that you might want to use forward deployment to bolster an extended deterrent threat. But if you want to go that route, it needs to be a sort of substantial number of troops that can actually change the balance of capabilities on the ground. These small contingents, again, we can only speak to the domestic political mechanism, but we don't think it works. And there are real costs that go beyond the financial cost of maintaining them abroad. For instance, there's other research that suggests that the maintenance of American troops in other countries reduces the willingness of the home country population to fight for their own defense, and also might have a bunch of other effects inside that country. I think that it's this sort of unexamined myth that really my sense is achieved the status of sort of taken for granted fact because Thomas Schelling wrote so beautifully and evocatively about it, and just hasn't been seen as fit to examine until now. Incidentally, there's other work, Mike Toms and Jessica Weeks, for instance, showing that alliance commitments, absent the presence of troops, actually do bolster domestic support for escalation in response to attack. So maybe that would be a cheaper way. If you do want to maintain these extended deterrent commitments, that might be a cheaper way of doing so.
Stephen Ward, thanks for talking with us today.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It was a pleasure, John.